Good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I will be chatting with Barry Bradford, recognized as one of America's best teachers and public speakers. He has won awards from the President, the Congress, and leading civil rights organizations. He may be best known for leading teams of students in pursuing justice in the Mississippi Burning Cold case that led to the conviction of KKK leader Edgar Ray Killen. Plus, he has researched and lectured on a number of historical issues, including the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And Barry, thanks so much for being here today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Jim, and hello to everybody who's listening.
You know, before we talk about your background as a teacher and your involvement with the Mississippi Burning case, which I do want to get into later, I would like to discuss your research on one of the most controversial events in U.S. history, the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And it has been over 50 years, and still we have inconclusive evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald was the only killer, or lone nut, as some people have said, who acted alone. I'd like you to tell me a little bit about Oswald. Is there anything in his background to suggest that he would contemplate such a violent act?
Well, Jim, before I answer that, let me go back to the premise of your question. You stated that there is inconclusive evidence, and I don't think that that is the case at all. I think the evidence is quite conclusive. It's not the conclusion that people want to hear, but the evidence overwhelmingly points to the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy with three shots fired from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building. His fingerprints were on the murder weapon. He practiced with the murder weapon. He was witnessed in the window of the depository building with the murder weapon. His wife thought he did it. His brother thought he did it. There is overwhelming evidence that Lee Harvey Oswald did it. Now, as to your question on Oswald's background, the phrase lone nut theory was coined in response to the Warren Commission's conclusion that Oswald had acted alone. But by adding the phrase lone nut, implying that this was an inconceivable act by somebody who had no motivation, doesn't accurately assess who Oswald was. Lee Harvey Oswald was a mentally unstable person. He was a very confused individual in many ways. At the age of 12 years old, Lee Harvey Oswald and his mother were living in New York City, where his violent outbursts against his mother, his mother, his half-brother, his sister-in-law, his constant truancy from school, his constant fighting, and his constant lying caused him to be reprimanded, often by schools, and most importantly, it caused him to undergo a mandatory psychiatric evaluation in New York City.
Yeah, I remember reading
now,
that.
This is at the age of 12. Lived to be 24. What do we know about Lee Oswald at the age of 12? We know that a psychiatrist assessed that Oswald was mentally ill, prone to narcissism, a compulsive liar, a violent person, and that when Oswald felt inferior or rejected or in any way inadequate, that he had fantasies, vivid fantasies, revolving around committing an act of violence to make himself feel more competent.
You know,
how much more evidence do we need than that this is not a lone nut?
You know, I kind of want to get back to his background, too, and maybe step forward a little bit. He was in the Marines. And he was at first recognized as a sniper and then downgraded to marksman. So he was really just an average shot in terms of that category, correct?
The statement is factually correct, but not correct in terms of its context. To say that Oswald was an average shot, you need to add a qualifying phrase. Oswald was an average shot by the standards of the United States Marine Corps. He was not an average shot by the standards of average American citizens. If you think about people who serve in the Marine Corps, they undergo constant training with weapons, and they have to be recertified on a periodic basis for their proficiency with weapons. Therefore, it's a safe assumption that somebody who grades out as an average shot in the Marine Corps would be a much better shot than somebody chosen as an average shot from the American population. Oswald was more than capable of using the weapon, of firing it accurately, and for those of your listeners who have experience with weapons, at the furthest point where he would have had to shoot President Kennedy, it was slightly less than 90 yards. That is not a hard shot for an average shot in the Marines. Marines generally have to qualify at several hundred yards. About 300 yards would be an average for them.
Well,
this was not a shot.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. Go ahead.
It wasn't a hard shot.
Assuming
that one knew how to use the specific weapon that Oswald used, the actual shot sequence, the amount of time he had, and his ratio of hits to misses that day were not particularly difficult.
I just want to play devil's advocate for a second. I'm going to go to April 10th, 1963. You probably know where I'm going. He tried to kill retired General Edwin Walker. And maybe a little bit about Walker. I guess he was anti-Kennedy and or anti-communist as well. I mean, Kennedy didn't like Walker so much, but I don't know if that's neither here nor there. But anyway, Oswald, and maybe it does relate, but Oswald tried to shoot him. He missed him from 100 feet away. I don't know if people know this little-known fact, and maybe it's not that little-known, but he did try to kill Walker from 100 feet away, which is less than where he was in the book depository, and he missed Walker. And so there's, I guess that's where I get into the inconclusive or conflicting evidence that you have out there. Yet he was able to hit Kennedy in a moving vehicle, slow as it was because of the turn there by the book depository. Yet he couldn't kill Walker, who was just 100 feet away, just sitting in his bedroom window. And so I'm just kind of throwing that out as well, in terms of him being an average shot.
Well, let's think about his attempt on Edwin Walker for a moment.
Yeah, go ahead.
What? Number one, that Oswald was violent. Number two, that Oswald was politically motivated. Number three, that Oswald contemplated murders using a rifle, all of which puts him in the right position to be the assassin of President Kennedy. Why did he miss General Walker?
He
took one shot at General Walker. He tried to shoot General Walker through windows, and the bullet was slightly deflected by a window pane and missed General Walker by a couple of inches.
Okay.
So the idea that he couldn't hit somebody from 100 feet away is not actually contextually correct. What we could say is that had Oswald had a second shot at Walker, he probably would have hit him. And how can I draw that conclusion? Easily. Oswald missed his first shot at the Kennedy limousine and hit with his second two shots. So that nothing you've just said does anything except to support the idea that Oswald was a violent, politically motivated assassin capable of shooting somebody with a rifle.
Let's focus on the events that occurred on November 22nd, 1963. John and Jacqueline Kennedy started the day out in cloudy Fort Worth. They come to Dallas. The sun starts to open up. And I have a question about the bubble top. Was that simply not used on the limousine that Jacqueline and JFK were in, simply because JFK just liked the sunshine and enjoyed seeing the crowds? Or do you think there was something more sinister to that? Because his staff knew that he was aware that he wasn't very popular with Dallas, many of the Dallas citizens. It seems like the climate there in Dallas, besides being sunny, though, on the outside, there was some fear that was going on in that city at the time.
Dallas was a hotbed of conservative, racist, right-wing, anti-Kennedy feeling. It was a very dangerous place for Kennedy to go. Adlai Stevenson had been there weeks earlier and had people try to hit him with placards and spit on him. The question about the bubble top is interesting. Today, in 2013, as you and I are recording this interview, Secret Service procedures are very, very, very different than they were in 1963. I've spoken with Secret Service agents who are very open about the fact that the Secret Service did not do their job as well as they should have in Dallas, not just because they lost the president, which in and of itself would argue that they hadn't done their job, but rather the Secret Service agents in Dallas allowed President Kennedy far too much latitude in dictating how his protection would be organized. The bubble top on the limo was not bulletproof. Its sole purpose was to protect Mrs. Kennedy's hair in case of rain, and as you correctly pointed out, it had been raining that morning. The Secret Service told Kennedy that they wanted the bubble top up because it would serve a second purpose, which is if somebody threw an object such as a rock or a stone from the side or attempted to hit him with a placard by running out into the street, that it would have a deterrent effect. Kennedy did not want the bubble top up. He felt that he needed to be as close to the people who were coming to watch his procession as possible. He was trying to be very open. The Secret Service today would not allow the president to dictate what protective measures they would take. The other thing that's interesting about the bubble top is looking back at what had happened to President Kennedy earlier in 1963. He had traveled overseas, and in Rome and in Dublin, Ireland, he was in an open-top car on narrow streets, and people rushed at the car and climbed up on the car. There were Secret Service agents in Rome and in Dublin who were standing on the rear bumpers of the car, but two agents, even two armed agents, can't fight off literally hundreds of people trying to get to the car. The Secret Service was extremely worried about the possibility of somebody hurting President Kennedy when he was in the car. Here's one other interesting note about the bubble top.
Well, one thing you pointed out, which I think is really interesting, it was really just to protect Jacqueline Kennedy's hair.
Yeah. I
thought it was more protective than that. I bet most people do. Interesting.
It's not a bulletproof plastic. However, what the Secret Service will acknowledge is that had Oswald fired his weapon from the Texas School Book Depository and had the bubble top been in place, although the bubble top would not have stopped the bullet, it very well might have deflected or moved the path of the bullet ever so slightly, and a matter of inches might have saved President Kennedy's life.
As it saved General Walker. Yeah. Exactly.
General Walker was saved by a wooden window frame. And after Oswald took his shot at Walker, Walker lived in a residential neighborhood. People heard the shot and began responding to it. So Oswald ran away, as he would run away from the Kennedy assassination. But in the case of Walker, that is what prevented him from taking a second shot.
You were going to make another point about the bubble, and I think I deterred you there. What else were you going to say? Another interesting thing about the bubble top.
The only other thing I was going to add on the bubble top was just that it would have had a slight deterrent effect in terms of its impact on the bullet. And so, although I don't know that anything would have stopped Oswald from shooting, had Oswald been looking out the window and seen the bubble top, it would have made his shot more difficult. There might have been reflection off of it. It also might have given him pause for a moment to wonder if it was bulletproof. It's one of those what-ifs about the assassination that doesn't change the fact of who shot the president, but makes us wonder what alternatives might have been available had people acted even slightly differently.
Okay, so we kind of left off where Jacqueline and JFK leave Fort Worth, arrive in Dallas, the motorcade begins. Meanwhile, Lee Harvey Oswald, this is, you know, minutes beforehand, I'm not sure the exact time, what is he doing, what preparations is he making in the book depository as Jacqueline and JFK are in the motorcade and about ready to leave the airport?
Well, why don't we back up a little bit and trace Oswald a little bit further back from his arrival at the depository.
Okay.
Harvey Oswald was an abusive husband who used to beat up his wife on a regular basis.
Marina, right.
The Russian emigre community in Dallas tried to protect Marina Oswald by providing her with money and with safe houses occasionally. Right before the assassination, on November 21st of 63, Lee Oswald went to his wife and begged her to take him back, promised not to hit her anymore, promised to be a better husband. And very significantly, Jim, Lee Oswald, on November 21st, 63, asked his wife to spend the next day with him, apartment hunting with her and the kids, and rebuilding their marriage.
Yeah, I remember reading that. Jeez.
Ald said yes, John F. Kennedy probably would not have been murdered. When Marina Oswald said no, because she had just been beaten up too many times, the next morning Oswald left her his wedding ring, which Marina Oswald testified he had never taken off before. He removed his wedding ring to signify the rupturing of their marriage and left it along with his cash for her. Then he went to her garage. She was living with a woman named Ruth Payne. He went to Ruth Payne's garage and he took his gun. Marina knew just where he kept the gun. He put it in a bag and was given a ride to work that morning. Remember that he worked at the Texas School Book Depository.
Right.
He didn't wander. That was his job.
And then he carpooled with a friend of his, right?
Carpooled with a friend who said Lee was carrying a large bag. When the police asked the friend about it, the friend said Lee had claimed it contained curtain rods that Marina had taken off of her windows. When the police arrived at Marina's house after the assassination, they found there were no curtain rods missing, but his weapon was missing. The gun was in the bag. He arrived at the Texas School Book Depository. He went up to his workspace on the sixth floor. He took boxes and used them to build a sniper's nest and would later use them to try and hide the rifle's location because he couldn't take the rifle out of the building. And he waited for the motorcade to come by. There are numerous witnesses to all of this, all of them employees of the Texas School Book Depository.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. What happened then at 12:30 in terms of, from your research, what then transpires at 12:30 p.m.? And we'll get to the other witnesses as well, but I just want to zero in on what you think occurred at 12:30 p.m. as the motorcade comes, you know, crosses the, makes the turn, comes by the book depository. What indeed happens?
Well, we have literally hundreds of witnesses standing along the side of the road on both sides. We have journalists in the motorcade on buses behind the president's car, including Jim Lehrer of the McNeil, Robert McNeil, who would later become famous for the McNeil-Lehrer report. We have lots of police in Dealey Plaza. So we have lots of witnesses. When you ask me what does my research suggest, I don't have to suggest anything. I can merely tell you what the witnesses saw. This is not a murder that happened in isolation. This is a murder that happened in public. As the motorcade made a 120-degree turn, it was on a short stretch of road passing through Dealey Plaza, which is a lovely area on the outskirts of downtown Dallas that has a number of lovely pergolas and a pool there that honor the birth of Dallas. As the car came down the street, Oswald took his rifle and shot three times from behind at the president's car. The Warren Commission deduced that the first shot taken by Oswald missed when it deflected off of a tree because of the angle that he was shooting from, not dissimilar to the Edwin Walker shooting. Mm-hmm. That bullet, according to the Warren Commission, hit the pavement and bounced up and hit a man named James Tague, who was standing under the triple underpass through which the president's motorcade would have to pass to get on the freeway in order to get to his speaking location. Now, the reason that I qualify with that statement with this is what the Warren Commission said is because James Tague is still alive and does not think that it was the first shot that hit him. He thinks it was a fragment of the second shot that hit him.
Hmm.
Ultimately, it's probably not terribly relevant because we know that Lee Oswald fired his weapon three times. There were three bullets missing from the gun, three cartridges on the floor of the Texas School Book Depository. They were fired from his gun with his fingerprints, from his workspace, out of a gun that he owned, that he had been photographed with and practiced shooting with. So the exact sequence of which shot hit James Tague is interesting, but maybe not definitive. The second shot hit President Kennedy, went through his throat, and hit Governor Connally, severely injuring him. Governor Connally needed extensive surgery after the assassination. And the third shot hit President Kennedy in the head, killing him on the spot. When President Kennedy was hit in the head, Jacqueline Kennedy began to crawl out of the back of the open limo. Many people assumed that what Jacqueline Kennedy was doing was logically and reasonably trying to get out of the line of fire, which seems like a completely rational response to me. But actually, what she was doing is she had seen part of the president's skull land on the back hood of the car, and she scooped it up in her right hand as Clint Hill, her personal Secret Service agent, ran up from behind and pushed her back into the car, and then the limo took off and got to Parkland Hospital.
Yeah, I remember that came out years later about his skull being back there. I think a lot of people, too, thought that maybe she was reaching to help Clint Hill get into the motor, the car as well, the limo as well.
No, actually, yeah. If you look closely at the Zapruder film, watch Jacqueline Kennedy's right hand. She is scooping something up and already beginning to move back toward the seat of the car,
mm-hmm.
because by the time the car got to Parkland Hospital, she had the president's head on her lap. She was trying to comfort him.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Kennedy later didn't have any memory of climbing out of the car. Not surprisingly, she was in shock at the moment. Clint Hill, however, the Secret Service agent who ran up to push her back in, is still alive and has a very clear memory of what happened.
You know, Abraham Zapruder, interesting local businessman, and he took the historic footage which you're referencing on his 8mm camera. Now, he and other witnesses have said they heard three shots. And there are other witnesses, for example, Gene Hill, who've said they've heard 4 or 6 shots. What I'd like to do when we come back from the break, Barry, is talk a little bit about the discrepancy between 3 shots, 6 shots, and the varying witness accounts when we come back. Okay?
We'll be glad to talk about that.
Okay, we'll be back right after this. And then, of course, is going back to the 1960s, Abraham, Martin, and John, and that is Dion. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Barry Bradford, and noted historian, a distinguished lecturer, and Illinois Teacher of the Year, National Teacher of the Year, and really getting some many, many insights here about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. You know, Barry, before the break, we were talking about the Zapruder film and also the fact that Oswald had fired 3 shots, but there were also listeners that indeed said that there were 4 to 6 shots. For example, Gene Hill had said that there were other shots fired. Where do you stand on that?
The overwhelming majority of the witnesses in Dealey Plaza said there were 3 shots fired. How overwhelming is that majority? 81% said that. But then, if you add up the other folks who heard a different number of shots other than 3, do you know what you find, Jim?
What do you find?
The most common result is 12% of the people thought there were 2 shots fired and not 3. The number of people who were in Dealey Plaza who testified that they heard more than 3 shots is 5%. What historians have to do is we have to consider all of the evidence and follow where the evidence logically takes us to. Folks who have a specific theory that they invariably come to will cherry-pick the facts that support their particular theory. So let's think about this one more time. If we add together the number of people who heard 2 shots to the number of people who heard 3 shots, that number comes out to 93%. 2% of the people in Dealey Plaza thought there was 1 shot fired. But here's what's intriguing, and then I'll be more than glad if you'd like to ask about Gene Hill to talk about
that. Yeah, I'm concerned about Gene Hill and the fact that she even saw a shooter on the grassy knoll.
But in order to understand how the conspiracy theorists would add up the shots, you have to understand how many shots they believe would have been fired. According to people who believe that Kennedy was hit by more than one assassin, they have to account for 4 to 6 shots fired. And the evidence just doesn't support it. What evidence am I referring to? The autopsy photos and the x-rays taken of Kennedy and Connally. And what about Governor Connally? What did he say? 3 shots were fired at him from the Texas School Book Depository. Mrs. Connally said the same thing. Is it a reasonable supposition that Governor Connally and Mrs. Connally would lie in order to allow the man who actually shot them to escape because they were part of a conspiracy? Here's another way to consider it. What did people standing in the plaza hear? They heard shots being fired in a crowded, noisy area with large buildings, cars moving in several directions, and people making general noise. Those folks who felt that they heard more than 3 shots were just as likely to have heard an echo or a reverberation as they were to have actually heard a separate shot. So if you consider what does the weight of evidence lead us to, almost everybody there, almost, not all, but almost everybody there heard 3 shots.
The 7% I guess, that's left? Because you said we added up 93% say there's three shots. And
no.
Okay, so the 7%, though, I don't know if we could just discount them completely.
4%, excuse me very much, 5% of the people there heard more than three shots.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for them to be correct, 95% of the people in Dealey Plaza had to hear it wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, I see where you're going. So, yeah, I mean,
let me offer you something here, Jim.
Sure.
I've got two lottery tickets, and you're going to win $1 million, which I'm guessing you could make good use of.
Sure.
That ticket A has a 95% chance of being the right ticket, and ticket B has a 5% chance of being the right ticket. Jim, which one would you choose?
Yeah, easy answer.
Yeah, and look at it in one more way. If the 95% of people who heard three shots or less are all part of a conspiracy, I ask your listeners to consider this. How easily could you be persuaded to lie in order to help the killer of the president escape justice?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess that is an issue, too. If Oswald was the lone shooter and there was a conspiracy, why didn't he have a better means to get away? I think that's one of the glaring things, don't you think?
Why didn't he have a better means to get away? Because he was doing it on his own.
Exactly.
He was doing a lot of planning. He did not have a good escape plan. In fact, he left most of his money for his wife that morning. When he shot at General Walker, he had left a long, very detailed letter for his wife indicating what she should do in the event that he was killed or captured that day.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Oswald, on the day he killed Kennedy, had a couple of days to think it through, but didn't firmly make up his mind, by my best guess, until Marina rejected him the night before.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have a coherent escape plan. He didn't have a way of getting away, and he didn't have the resources to get away.
Mm-hmm. If we're going to talk about the conspiracy theory, and obviously there's many people, including Oliver Stone and a number of others, thousands of people. In fact, I think the poll that came out recently said that most Americans, 75%, believe there was a conspiracy. Though you're showing pretty much step by step that that's not the case, that Oswald was the lone shooter. But there are some odd things out there, and you know, things like, for example, why wasn't the autopsy done in Dallas? Why was it done in Washington, D.C. at the Naval Hospital? And why not go to Walter Reed? I mean, you've got a lot of kind of odd things like that that are kind of, that creep in, that make you just curious and wonder, why was it done in that particular way? Why not do the autopsy in Dallas? Or then, why not go back to Walter Reed, where the facilities were, as I understand, much better than they were at the Naval Hospital in Maryland?
Well, first of all, curiosity is a good thing, and it is important to ask the questions, because by asking questions, we can hopefully get to clear answers. But in order to get to those clear answers, we have to look at what does the evidence actually show us. So I want to go back to a point you made, and to which you implied a significance that I don't think is valid. You said that 75% of the American public believes there was a conspiracy. I believe the actual number is closer to 60%.
I was quoting the Time magazine from November 25th, 2013.
Okay.
But either way, the percentage is higher than 50%, let's say.
Absolutely. There is no I don't think there's any doubt about
right.
that. The question you is, what's significant about that?
What is significant about that?
Why would that number be significant? If you ask the general population of the United States of America who have not closely looked at the evidence
mm-hmm.
or been exposed to much except Oliver Stone's movie and conspiracy theories that pop up on the History Channel all the time, how would they come to a conclusion? If 70% of the American public believe something without studying it or knowing anything about it, just giving their opinion, the only significance to that is that they've been exposed to a lot of information. Let me give you a counter idea.
Sure.
That same magazine, Time Magazine, a few years ago, surveyed American citizens and said, who was the greatest president of all time? Every president who made their list was president since 1960. Abraham Lincoln didn't make the list. George Washington didn't make the list. Andrew Jackson didn't make the list. Teddy Roosevelt didn't make the list.
Mm-hmm.
But would we conclude that because the majority of the largest vote-getter in that particular poll was Ronald Reagan, should we therefore conclude that Ronald Reagan was indeed the greatest president in American history?
Right, I see where you're going with the polls. Right. It's more a popular vote than anything else, and it more of a current vote, what's going on at that particular time period. Okay, but maybe let's get back, though, to a couple of things here, though. We had left off a little bit with the autopsy, and I had asked, you know, why not? These are the questions that come up, though, Barry, for example. You know, why not go to Walter Reed? Why to go to the Naval Hospital in Maryland, where some theorists have said that was the autopsy was botched? Why not do it in Dallas at the time?
Well, it's two different questions.
You're right.
The first question is, why wasn't it done in Dallas?
Right.
And I can give you an easy, clear, and definitive answer to that. Lyndon Johnson did not want to leave Dallas without Jacqueline Kennedy. People had said to him that they could easily send a plane for Mrs. Kennedy in a few days when the autopsy would be done in Dallas. However, Mrs. Kennedy let Johnson know through intermediaries that she would not leave Dallas without her husband, and Lyndon Johnson decided that he would not leave Dallas without Jacqueline Kennedy. He therefore sent word that the body was to be removed illegally from Dallas. Now, whether Lyndon Johnson specifically knew that it was illegal to remove the body, I don't know. I would tend to doubt that he would be up on that specific provision of Texas law. But it's interesting that in 1963, murdering the president was not a federal crime. It was a local murder. Under Texas law, the body should have been left in Texas for a full autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason it was removed at gunpoint by federal agents out of a Dallas hospital was Lyndon Johnson said to do that. Now, why was the autopsy done at Walter Reed?
Well, it was done at the Naval Hospital and not Walter Reed, right?
Right. The doctors at the Naval base who did the autopsy, led by James Hume, who was a commander in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Navy. He also held the title of director of the lab for the Naval Medical School. Remember that Kennedy was a Navy man and not an Army man. He had been certified by the American Board of Pathology. He was assisted by men who were also certified in clinical pathology. He was assisted by the man who was the chief of the wound ballistics pathology branch for the Armed Forces Initiative of Pathology. He was assisted by men who were certified in anatomic pathology and in forensic pathology.
Well, you make a good case there.
Yeah. I mean, you can simply look at what were the actual credentials of the doctors who did the autopsy and question, why would you think these people weren't qualified to do it?
Mm-hmm.
You heard rattle off their list of credentials. And I could actually go into greater detail about that, but I think the point is made.
No, you've made the point. And, okay, the other thing is Oswald would say he was go ahead.
More importantly,
mm-hmm.
not only did the doctors in Dallas generally agree that the president was shot from behind.
Mm-hmm.
The exception was a doctor who was not close to Kennedy as the autopsy was being done, or the procedures were being done in Dallas. The doctors in the Navy all of whom were certified pathologists, agreed that the president was shot from behind. But there was a comedian, and I apologize, I can't remember his name, who used to say, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? They took x-rays and photographs. Those x-rays and photographs are not secret. Doctors have gone for many, many years into the archives of the United States and looked at them and all generally come to the same conclusion. But President Kennedy was shot from behind.
I tell you, one more question before the break, and this is something that's kind of interesting, too. You know, a lot of the evidence itself was washed away, and agents, immediately after Kennedy was pronounced dead, almost immediately, agents were seen immediately beginning to scrubbing down the limousine. Well, that's really tampering with evidence, though. And again, I'm playing devil's advocate here. There's things like that that come out that just make you wonder.
Well, is it destroying evidence? Absolutely. Did it happen? There's no question. The Secret Service openly admits to it. But the implication of the question is that there was some nefarious purpose to that.
Right.
Actually, again, remembering that the Secret Service would do it completely differently today, that any police or investigative agency would do it completely differently today, we have to remember what procedures were like in 1963, not what are they like in 2013. We've spent the last few years as Americans watching things on television that show forensic pathologists looking at the intestines of bugs to figure out the time of death of a cadaver left in a sagebrush desert. That didn't exist in 1963. Okay, so why was the car wiped down? The answer is so simple. It's not right, but it's very simple. The Secret Service assumed that they would have to bring Lyndon Johnson from Parkland Hospital to Love Field Airport in the safest possible vehicle, which was President Kennedy's limo. They washed it down so that the President Johnson wouldn't have to sit in President Kennedy's brains and blood.
You know, I did not know that. And I tell you, you have clarified a number of things in the time we've been together. I tell you, we're going to take another short break, Barry. When we come back, I would like to wind up a little bit about the JFK conspiracy ideas, the assassination. And we'll be back more with Barry Bradford right after this. And that is Tom Petty, and I won't back down. And Barry, before the break there, we were talking, of course, about the conspiracies and John F. Kennedy and the assassination, and there are a couple of one or two details that still kind of are glaring, and one of those is Jack Ruby. It just seems very convenient that he was shot, and we never did get to the truth because we never got to hear Oswald's story, his take of it. What do you make of the whole Jack Ruby incident?
Well, I completely agree that if Jack Ruby had not killed Lee Oswald, that we would know a great deal more about Oswald's motivation for killing the president. Oswald had been interviewed any number of times over the years by people from psychiatrists to embassy officials, to a TV reporter in New Orleans. And the best that we can say about Oswald is that he was, in the words of Stephen King, a semi-educated hillbilly with delusions of grandeur, as King put it, that Oswald's thinking was often muddled and muddied. And had he been not killed, I think we would know a great deal more about his motivation because he would have talked. Why did Jack Ruby kill him? Jack Ruby killed him because Jack Ruby had a long, long history of violence. Jack Ruby had a great hatred of women being abused. On the day of the Kennedy assassination, Ruby told his rabbi, Rabbi Silverman, told employees at his club, and later told Dallas newspaper reporters that he couldn't sleep, he couldn't stop crying, that he was obsessed with the fact that Jacqueline Kennedy would have to come back to Dallas to testify. He killed Lee Oswald because he thought he would be a hero, he thought he would be famous, and because he hated Oswald for what he had done.
So he was trying to basically soothe not only himself, but also Jacqueline Kennedy. At least that's some of the research that I've read. But at by the same token, though, he was able to get into the county jail or city jail without any problems at all and walk right up and shoot him.
Sure. And that really points to the incompetence of the Dallas Police Department, which makes so many blunders that weekend that it is almost indescribable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I guess my last question then, and by the way, you've hit so many insights here, much appreciated. How would you assess the Warren Commission? The findings.
The Warren Commission was a badly run investigation that came to the correct conclusion. In 1978, the United States House of Representatives reopened the Kennedy assassination. Their conclusion was based on incorrect interpretation of acoustic evidence that can be proven to be wrong today. But overall, the House of Representatives did a better and more creditable job of investigating than the Warren Commission did. One of the things that the Warren Commission lacked was they lacked the cooperation, the full cooperation of the CIA and the FBI. The FBI had destroyed evidence, literally destroyed evidence, because it made them look bad for not following up on threats made by Oswald. The CIA destroyed evidence because it pointed to illegal activities of their own involving the attempted murder of Fidel Castro, and also to the CIA's incompetence in not recognizing that Oswald was more than just kind of an eccentric crank. You asked me earlier, may I take a moment and answer your question about Gene Hill?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Gene Hill was a witness standing very, very close to where the president and Mrs. Kennedy were in the car when they were killed. In fact, she and her friend, Mary Moorman, were standing as close to the president as it is just about possible for somebody to have been.
By the way, there might be some listeners who are joining us late. Gene Hill, of course, is the one of the other witnesses, along with Zapruder and a number of others, who claims that she heard from 4 to 6 shots. Go ahead.
Well, Zapruder never claimed he heard 4 to 6
shots.
No,
he heard. He said he heard 3 shots. I'm just saying other witnesses. But Gene Hill was a witness who came up and heard 4 to 6 shots. But, yeah, go ahead. You were going to say?
Okay. Well, Gene Hill was standing very close to where the president was, and in her direct line of sight across the street was the grassy knoll. In 1988, the History Channel began broadcasting, or A&E Network began broadcasting, a documentary series called The Men Who Killed Kennedy. Hmm. One of the reasons why so many Americans believe there was conspiracy is because the History Channel broadcast these documentaries, and people made the conclusion, if it's on the History Channel, it must be right. One of the most decisive moments in the History Channel documentaries, which were actually produced by in Britain, but narrated in America by Bill Curtis, was Gene Hill saying, I was standing right across the street from the president next to my friend Mary Moorman. I heard 4 to 6 shots. I saw a shooter on the grassy knoll. I ran up pointing, trying to get people to come up the grassy knoll to chase him, and I couldn't get him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And many Americans who have seen that documentary series look at that and they go, okay, there is your proof. There is the eyewitness who says, I saw a shooter.
Mm-hmm.
So what do we do with Gene Hill's testimony? Well, the first thing we do is to ask, When did Gene Hill start saying that? 40 minutes after the assassination, Gene Hill was on live television in Dallas. She was asked a direct question. Did you see anybody fire a weapon? She said she saw nobody fire a weapon. She makes no reference to 4 to 6 shots. She makes no reference to the grassy knoll. 40 minutes after the assassination, the police were already looking for the guy from the Texas School Book Depository, Lee Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think if Gene Hill actually saw a shooter on the grassy knoll, she would have said so on television? Guys, you're chasing the wrong person. So the first way we can prove Gene Hill is lying is by quoting Gene Hill. She says she's lying. They quote her friend, Mary Moorman, who is standing next to her, who is still alive. There's a long, about 40-minute interview with her on YouTube in which she said Gene Hill is lying, that every time somebody put a camera in Gene Hill's face, her story got more and more fanciful, more and more colorful, more and more inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, photographs of the first policeman to reach the grassy knoll, a guy named Clyde Haygood, shows that Gene Hill did not sprint up the grassy knoll, as she claims in the History Channel documentary, that she was still laying on the ground 90 seconds later. So this is what you have to do when you look at what you think you know about the Kennedy assassination. You have to go back and closely look at what was really said. What does the actual evidence show? And before I let you finish, Jim, you had asked me why specifically was the autopsy done at a naval hospital as opposed to Walter Reed? And the specific answer to that is Mrs. Kennedy requested it because her husband was a Navy man. Now, again, today, procedures are very different. The widow of a president can't dictate something like that. As a courtesy to Mrs. Kennedy, that's why it was done there.
I want to tell you, you have come up with many, many insights which would tend to disavow many of the conspiracy theories. And I guess until this interview, I was pretty certain that there were two shooters, one Lee Harvey Oswald and someone else. But I tell you, lots of interesting insights, and I'm sure I, along with listeners, will continue to view the JFK assassination with a jaundiced eye. And I tell you, Barry, it has been a pleasure for me to have you on the show and to, again, give so many wonderful perceptions and insights and really historical data regarding the JFK assassination. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Jim, it's been a pleasure to be on here, and it's been a pleasure to talk with you and to talk to your listeners. You know, there were a lot of secret documents after Kennedy was shot. They've been released now with the exception of the last 2,000 pages, which are scheduled to be released in 2017. So let's make a date to come back and talk after the last documents have been released, and we'll see if there's any change to our conclusion.
Hey, I welcome that, Barry. Thanks again. By the way,
thank you, Jim.
Oh, you're again, thank you. If you wish to contact Barry Bradford, award-winning teacher and public speaker, visit his website, BarryBradford.com. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.